To me, mostly, I think this has been a reminder again that things are not black and white. And in a way, two things can be true at the same time. On the one hand, when we think about sustainability in general, when you think about the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, they are a vision for a sustainable future. It is an aspiration to how we want the world to look. That's not the same thing as saying that you will get to that today. And I think certainly the current situation in the global energy markets are a huge reminder that you cannot just switch from where we are today to a sustainable future in a second, that we need a transition. We need a transition in terms of energy. We need a transition actually from most sustainability perspectives.
I'm Jim Haskell, editor of the Bridgewater Daily Observations. The war in Ukraine has raised a number of important investment topics, and we've tried to cover that in the Daily Observations, both in written and podcast form. One of those topics is ESG and sustainability. And so in today's podcast, we're joined by co-CIOs for sustainability, Karen Carney-Altambor and Carsten Stendevad, to discuss what sustainable investing looks like in a post-Russia invasion world. So here, let me turn now to my colleague, Jake Davidson, who actually moderated this discussion. And Jake, what are the big topics that you focused on?
The first thing we focused on was how the war has really changed how private actors think about having an impact, considering the massive divestment that we've seen from Russia, even in ways that, as Karen explains, are not necessarily economic. Then another important point is how the invasion has added some nuance around what kind of assets are and aren't sustainable, particularly with regards to fossil fuels. And then also what the big commodity price rally we've seen means for sustainability policy worldwide. And then on the portfolio construction side, how investors can still protect themselves from rising inflationary pressures that the war has exacerbated without holding assets like oil. And then we also hit on some of the critiques of ESG in terms of generating alpha and also the ability of investors to have impact in public markets. So it's a really comprehensive discussion, and I think it touches on some of the biggest questions investors have about sustainability.
Great. So let's jump right in to your discussion with both Karen and Carsten.
So Carsten, Karen, thanks so much for joining. And just to set the context, you know, we always want to check in with our people across the firm and get their thoughts on the biggest events in their space. And that's especially true here with the Russia invasion of Ukraine, which intersects in so many different ways with sustainability and ESG and so forth. And so the first question I want to ask you is just about the economic response to the war in Ukraine, because in some sense, this is the biggest divestment from a market that we've ever seen in both magnitude and speed. And so just interested in your thoughts on what the implications are from an ESG point of view.
What I'd say is that it is really interesting when I think back at the last few years, when we started talking to different institutional money managers about explicitly making decisions about what they were going to hold based on non-financial considerations and thinking about the impact of where their capital goes and how their capital might have second and third order consequences in the world, I'd say that sounded a little bit controversial. And a lot of people said, you know, that's not in my mandate. I don't do that. I just have financial goals. And then we look back at this event, it seems like a very large number of private sector players took it as intuitive, obvious, you know, very much easy to explain that they made major decisions for non-financial reasons, that they made major decisions to align their capital based on non-financial considerations. So to us, that's a watershed moment because just such a large number of players chose to make decisions in terms of their investments based on explicitly thinking, wait, my money and where it's going could have an impact, could change what's happening in the world, could have second and third order consequences that will determine what kind of world we live in. And we think that's a watershed moment because it'd be very intuitive to start thinking more broadly about all the different ways that your money has an impact that may have not been as obvious ahead of this invasion.
And the debate around, well, how should I weigh financial versus non-financial considerations? Are there trade-offs? Of course, that's a very relevant question. But notice how that really has not been voiced as much in this case. It's been so clear that we have a preference. We have a clear non-financial preference for how we deploy the capital. And in many cases, investors and companies have done it at quite a significant financial loss, but exactly because these preferences were so clear, they were willing to do it. Now, of course, it's also an extreme situation with this tragic invasion of Ukraine. So obviously, this is not a an event or a circumstance like most other sustainability related topics. But nevertheless, it's just interesting to see this global consensus emerge so fast about what is required to do if you're a private actor in the global economy.
You know, the other thing I would add to that is that I think it's also expanded investors' views of what impact through public markets might mean. Because a lot of the discussions we had ahead of this really circled around this idea of how much impact can you really have as, you know, one capital provider? How much impact do you really have in private public markets? You know, so many people hold a certain company, hold a certain bonds. Does it really matter if you invest or you don't? And we think those are great questions. And these are the right, you know, kind of theories of change and questions people should be asking. We don't see them that differently than questions of like, should you vote? Like anyone vote doesn't matter. But going through this experience, I think really widened people's views of what the implications could be. How are the ways that private capital could actually matter to outcomes in the world? You know, before Russia's invasion of Ukraine, we wouldn't even be talking about questions like, what's it like if Visa stops servicing a country? Or what does it mean if, you know, McDonald's stops selling somewhere, or if companies stop certain, you know, joint ventures that they have? And so we've just seen a much wider array of ways that investors can say, these are ways that my money may have an impact in the real world. And that really opens up a lot of possibilities.
I want to ask you a question about some of the nuances around sustainable investing that have been highlighted by this crisis, because when you think about sustainability and defining what sustainability is, you know, there's always been a consensus that investing in something like fossil fuels is not furthering sustainable outcomes. And I think the Ukraine invasion has maybe added some ambiguity there, that perhaps fossil fuel investment could be important for sustaining democracy, for example. Have you seen a shift or a change in the debate around what sustainability means?
Well, to me, mostly, I think this has been a reminder again that things are not black and white. And in a way, two things can be true at the same time. On the one hand, when we think about sustainability in general, when you think about the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, they are a vision for a sustainable future. It is an aspiration to how we want the world to look. And if you're a sustainable investor, you're trying to allocate your capital towards those outcomes. So at the margin, you help or you support the development of the world in that direction. That's not the same thing as saying that you will get to that today. And I think certainly the current situation in the global energy markets are a huge reminder that you cannot just switch from where we are today to a sustainable future in a second, that we need a transition. We need a transition in terms of energy. We need a transition actually from most sustainability perspectives. I think the whole trick is there a world where you, on the one hand, can maintain the vision of where you want the world to go, but you also acknowledge the reality that we have to. It takes time. It takes investments. It takes cost. It takes energy to get from where we are today to that world, and therefore, what it means is even if you were to invest, the world needs energy today. The world needs oil today, and we also know that in the future we would prefer the world not to use oil. So how can you reconcile the two? And I think it is very much looking at it, for example, in the case of companies, to say, well, we understand you cannot be net zero today, but what is the path? Even if you are doing unsustainable things today, is there still a path that you have towards a more sustainable future? I don't think you can take it this far as to say, well, there you go. We can't just shift to renewables. Therefore, we need to stay with the status quo. No, it's moving towards what we want, but recognizing that we can't get there in one day. And then I think as an investor, you can ask yourself the question of, at the margin, what's the development of the world that you're trying to promote from your impact perspective. And I do think it's great that you lean into sustainable outcomes to the extent that you can.
Karen, I want to get your thoughts too. I think what Carson's saying makes sense in terms of investing for a transition and not in the completely binary, no fossil fuels or no green energy kind of way. But does this mean that sustainability, at least in the short term, could include fossil fuels to some extent?
The commitment most investors have made on energy is that they want their portfolio to be consistent with net zero, which is an over time perspective that governments have signed onto of sort of where we want to be in the next 30 years in order to avoid the worst damages of climate change. And it was always questionable what path should the world take to actually getting to net zero by 2050. And therefore, if you're an investor, what does it mean for your portfolio to be, you know, both consistent with that path or even actively pushing or making that path more likely? And the way I see it, you know, Russia invades the Ukraine and that raises new perspectives to the energy transition, namely energy security becomes, you know, paramountly important for countries that weren't thinking about it that seriously and creates, you know, different supply demand dynamics. And very appropriately, it's raising questions about what is the best way to do an energy transition. So let me take a significant example with U.S. shale, which is I think there's pretty good arguments that actually the right way for the world to make a transition to net zero would actually be to pump more shale today. Because if you're short oil today, if you have a choice between capital investments that are 20 years capital investments or extremely dirty oil like tar sands versus shale, shale might actually be your best option because you make investments and they die off pretty quickly. So you're not committing to keep getting oil out of the ground all the way to 2050. And so that might be a very reasonable approach to what actually is a good way to get to net zero. Then you have the question as an investor of what role do I want to play? You may think as an investor, actually the best thing to do is pump shale and still might not want that to be your capital and your profits because you might think, well, I still want to be on the side of making the incentives as much as possible to contribute to the green transition. And the price incentives are already there. They don't need my capital. You might think actually the most important places to provide capital are to accelerating the technologies to get us all the way to net zero, to providing capital to the emerging world. So you might still not choose to go provide your capital in that direction. From my perspective, the most important question that investors that have net zero commitments need to ask themselves are they've already committed, like these investors have already committed that they want to, you know, be a part of that path. They're already saying that they're overlaying their portfolio with these considerations, with wanting, you know, net zero to be part of what they're accomplishing with their capital. And the how, the question of how does it make sense depending on your particular skill set, opportunity set, and what it means to be consistent with net zero are tough questions for every investor to wrestle with. And ones that we've had, you know, great conversations with a lot of our clients asking these questions and looking at their portfolios and saying, how would you think about meeting your net zero commitments and contributing as much as you can to whatever that path might be?
How do you think the Russia invasion is going to affect this transition to net zero? Will this be an incentive to move even more toward sustainable energy sources or a setback because many countries will need to move even more toward less green sources in the near term?
Probably one of the most important things that came out of Russia's invasion of Ukraine in sort of the medium term as a research organization interested in sustainability issues is exactly that, is that we need to look at this event as one that causes us to rethink how do we think that the world is going to respond to climate change. As researchers, we don't come at it from a perspective that we know the world will succeed. The world might fail. The world might totally fail to get to net zero. It may not transition. What's important to us as researchers understanding the world is to objectively look at the world and say, what is likely to happen and why? What are the incentives being set up? And we look at Russia's invasion of Ukraine as something that, you know, it's not clear yet what direction it's going to go. In the very near term, you know, two things have happened. One is that by, you know, creating this supply, you know, squeeze and creating this pricing mechanism, some of the tools that people actually thought would be helpful to accelerate the climate transition have been put in place. In other words, actually the quote unquote bad energy is getting more expensive. But of course, that's not happening in the best way because it's not like coal is getting most scarce relative to natural gas when coal is the worst for the environment and natural gas is better than that. It's happening based on what is it that Russia is most central to, which natural gas is what's going to be most scarce given Russia's invasion. The second piece is that if we had just taxed all of these you know, sources of energy through cap and trade systems, we'd have this big windfall now that we could choose what to do with as a society and say, you know, let's go help poor people that have greater costs of energy in their lives. Let's go invest in things. But that's not the case. You know, producers are going to get this windfall. So that's not a great set of circumstances because it means that it's going to be more politically sensitive, more painful, and we're going to harm members of society that are least able to kind of withstand these increases of energy. And the reduction in supply in the near term probably means in the very near term, the energy supplies that can be ramped up most quickly, some of them are not the cleanest. Some of them might be we actually use more coal in the near term in order to kind of get over this hump. But there's also opportunity here. There's opportunity here that having this price mechanism, having a supply squeeze raises, you know, kind of the urgency that many parts of the world feel to build out greener infrastructure, and that the, you know, kind of energy security mandate also accelerates this idea that actually green energy is a lot more secure because it's your own sunlight or it's your own wind. You're not importing it the same way. And we're seeing very promising signs in Europe that was already very committed to combating climate change is now also becoming very committed to dealing with their energy security. Real quality discussions happening about how do we accelerate in a meaningful way our ability to increase our renewable capacity. So if you add those things up, we could actually end up, you know, moving faster towards curbing climate change than previously before the invasion. We don't know what part that's going to land. Our job as researchers is to keep studying these things, looking for guideposts, seeing how the world evolves.
And then just to follow up on that, Europe in particular has been sort of publicly debating how it's going to get off Russian gas, and therefore it's been a little bit more transparent. Is there anything you're kind of seeing that's more concrete as to how Europe's planning to do that, how its energy transition over the next, you know, 7 to 10 years is going to look?
Well, I think the world is lucky that the consensus in Europe that curbing climate change is important is extremely powerful. I've personally heard it described to me by European policymakers as the strongest policy consensus in a generation. So we went into this crisis with very strong public consensus about curbing climate change. Now, of course, Europe also feels much more directly threatened by what's happening in Russia than other countries. And so I believe the consensus about security policy is also going to be very strong and enduring in the same way. What we're seeing happen mostly is a real redoubling of energy to say, can we even go faster? I think that you're seeing Europeans say, we really have to deal with our security challenge and we want to cut out Russia. We don't want to be dependent on them. But at the same time, we don't want to accept that the answer to that is going backward on our climate commitments. And, you know, in the worst case, actually going back to coal. That's not what we want. And so you add those two things up and you're getting, I think, a degree of policymaker energy and creativity and applying solutions that were previously not considered on the table, like extending the life of nuclear. That's hopefully going to push us to a much more concerted effort to build out renewable energy capacity in Europe than they were planning before. And they were already relatively ambitious before this. In their near term, Europe will probably move backwards, but with them, it's likely to, you know, move them forward faster. And if you think about, you know, we've talked before about sort of our framework of all the different ways that you can accelerate curbing climate change. And we've said that there are real challenges in this inflationary environment to be reliant on just making energy expensive and cutting off supply. Europe seems to be moving most aggressively to use the tools that we have said are likely the most helpful in this environment, which is, you know, public support, funding, incentives, subsidies, very clear direction of wanting to add renewable capacity and putting the positions in place to make that happen.
I want to move to some of the critiques on ESG investing that have come up maybe over the last few months and also maybe heightened by the Ukraine invasion. One of them is just, you know, when we talk about ESG, can mean so many things. And what we talked about so far is ESG and having impact. There's another kind of ESG that is more about alpha, outperforming by removing certain risks. So for example, climate risk or governance risk or social risk. And I think the critique that some have raised following the Russia invasion is that that sort of ESG kind of missed this one. They're revealed there's an additional tail risk for energy that actually could go the other way. The governance component or the social component didn't really seem to emphasize governments like Russia. How do you interpret that, and how should investors interpret that?
Well, I think so. ESG considerations, they matter, as you say, both from a risk return perspective and from an impact perspective. And we've spoken a lot about the impact side. From the risk side, you know, it's one out of many considerations that drive a financial decision. And I think the critics of ESG investing, I think, have a point that if investors who are into ESG, if they exaggerate the importance of ESG issues for their financial returns, if they exaggerate the predictive power of those ESG factors for their financial returns, I don't think that's helpful for anyone. It will be, when you just think about it from a financial perspective, these ESG issues are important, but they're one out of a number of factors that play in. which is why it's so important to be very clear about when we talk about ESG issues, why do we talk about them? Of course, to the extent that it helps you make good financial decisions, that's great. But if you really, what you're saying is you have this, it's really about a preference for where you want to deploy your capital in terms of how you want the world to evolve, you should be explicit about that and not confound the two. And I think a lot of the critique of ESG investing has been about really pointing out that when investors aren't clear about what they mean by ESG, it can lead to confusion.
I think there's been a lot of confusion with this idea that if only investors consider social and governance or environmental issues, they're sure to make more money. And our perspective has always been, look, it's always been the job of investment managers to consider everything they can about the world. And the realization that some of what investment managers should consider are things like governance in the world is hardly new. This is not some new movement. What's new about this movement is considering the impact of your capital. So if you look back and say, look, all the different ways people thought about the world, did people sufficiently foresee what was going to happen in Russia? You know, you could critique people regardless of whether they intend to be ESG investors or not, in the fact that most people did not predict that we would end up where we are today. And of course, if you had predicted it, you could have made lots of money, as is true for being able to predict almost any outcome in the world. I don't think that has almost anything to do with investors' decisions to prioritize the impact of where their capital is going. And if investors look for sort of magic bullets, if I just consider this factor, I'll never lose money, you know, you'll always end up disappointed.
I think that makes sense on the alpha side. And then I think there's also a question in terms of if you're building a portfolio where you want to have risk and return goals, but also have impact, you know, can you match the risk and return of a portfolio that's not constrained for sustainability reasons? And again, I think that question might be being asked more now when you see oil prices going up, or just generally, you know, we've talked about the importance of commodities in diversification in an inflationary environment. How should investors think about their ability to still be able to diversify and at least to achieve a good risk and return while having impact?
Yeah, I'm thrilled you asked that question because it is very core to the research that we've been doing, because our approach is that anytime you put any considerations on your portfolio in addition to risk and return, you're putting some degree of constraint. You're putting some degree of other goals and other perspectives. And that means that you have a chance of lowering your diversification. And that means that it's extremely important to be trying to maximize how much diversification you can have with the choices in front of you, adding your additional goals. And what we see when we look at most investor portfolios, whether they have ESG goals or not, is most investors are under-diversified. And you see that within asset classes, you have across asset classes. Most investors have not taken full advantage of the diversification that is available. And a great example of this is most investors don't even hold commodities, but if they do, they often hold the GSCI, which is basically just oil. And so they end up with a commodity exposure that's extremely concentrated in one thing. And so our perspective is the most important thing to do is to maximize the opportunities for diversification. And if you want to overlay additional considerations and goals that are important to you, that just makes that task, you know, even more important. When we look at the world, we see a very large array of assets that can meet sustainability goals. And so we firmly believe, and we've tried to illustrate this in portfolio construction, that investors can build highly diversified portfolios with sustainability considerations, because there's just enough assets out there that are available to do that. And yes, those portfolios would be slightly less diversified than if you never thought about sustainability, but they would still be massively more diversified than what most investors are doing without even overlaying anything, just taking things off the shelf and not thinking about diversification. And so as we see more and more investors add considerations like net zero, like divesting from Russia, add all sorts of considerations for what they're trying to accomplish with their capital, we think that the mandate, the importance of saying, I really have to make sure I'm maximizing the opportunities for diversification just rises. And we feel very confident that there's just such a large group, array of assets that you can hold that will meet your sustainability goals, that you will be able to be extremely diversified even with those sustainability goals.
when we talk about building sustainable portfolios that also are great from a financial perspective, it's true that there's certain constraints, like, for example, not being able to invest in oil. That is a significant constraint for a portfolio. Then the question becomes, is there a way of creating a similar type of inflation protection that oil could afford you, but in a more sustainable manner? Let's just talk about commodities. Let's talk about oil versus metals. If you think about what a sustainable world will look like in 2030, hopefully we will have much less oil, but actually metals will be absolutely critical for a sustainable world. We need that for electrical vehicles, the electric grid, et cetera. And from a financial perspective, you can get inflation protection from both. So it's an example of where, yes, if you have a high bar for sustainability, you may face certain constraints, but there are ways to work around those constraints and create similar financial exposures that deliver both what you need from a financial perspective, let's say inflation protection, but also ensures that your capital is directed towards sustainable outcomes.
You know, we talked about some of the critiques of ESG in terms of alpha. There's also been critiques of ESG in terms of having impact. And I think there's sort of two main strains of that. One is that it's difficult to actually have impact through investing in public markets, that you're sort of, you know, you're moving shares that already exist around, but not necessarily meaningfully affecting capital allocation. And then the other being that this isn't even a good way to have impact. That even if you were able to have some modicum of a difference through your investment portfolio, the real thing is to have influence through policy, and that ESG or sustainable investing is a distraction from that. So just interested to get your thoughts on those.
Let me take the last one first. You can be a strong believer in sustainable investing, but that doesn't mean you think that is the most important thing in the world to create a sustainable future. There's no doubt that policies obviously have the biggest impact in terms of how the world is put together, whether we can shift the direction of a society. Obviously, the political system and policies are the most important driver of that. But that doesn't mean it's the only driver of it. And in fact, when it comes to sustainability, you could argue that the private sector and the financial community in some areas have been leaning more into that transition than the policies certainly in certain countries. So it's not really an either or. It's in an ideal world, it's you have a situation where it's reinforcing each other. And somehow the notion that if the private sector and the financial sector, if they focus on sustainability, that means the policy world will not have to focus on it, I don't really buy that argument. If anything, I think it's the opposite. I think the more you have the different financial actors of society lean in a certain direction, I think it has a potential to create a positive loop that can feed off each other. There's nothing that investors who are focused on sustainability, there's nothing that they want more than policies that promote sustainability. So this is really not, I think it's a false opposition between those two those two actors. We need both of them. And then when it comes to the question of, well, what does it mean? Does it really matter to be to focus on sustainability in public markets? I think it's important to note a couple of items. Number one, you need the entire financial system to lean into sustainability if you want to reach a sustainable future. We know that there are trillions of dollars of financing needs to get to that point. Therefore, you need everything from the banking sector to the liquid markets, to the private markets, to the venture capital markets, to the blended finance markets, to the philanthropic capital. You need the entire system to lean into sustainability. And it's true that probably per unit of dollars, if you go into blended finance in sub-Saharan Africa, you could probably get a bigger impact per dollar than if you buy a stock. But the point is, we need trillions of dollars to lean into sustainability. And for that, you need the whole system to lean into it. And therefore, we also have to think about the life cycle of particular assets. Offshore wind, 15 years ago, did not really have that much access to the public markets. Today, they have plenty of access. Is that a good thing or a bad thing for sustainability? I would submit it's a great thing. It means that their cost of capital has come down, and which is great because we need to put up a ton of that capacity. So it's great if investors who are in the liquid markets are leaning towards that. So again, I don't think it's relevant to create these this dichotomy between different types of capital. Rather, I think the question should be, given the type of capital you are, how much can you lean in to the impact dimension? And if everyone does that, it will be good for the transition to a sustainable world.
I'll add one more thing related to what Carsten said, which is it's always a good excuse for government to say, well, I can't do these particular policies because the private sector, they'll freak out. The economy will crash. Oh my God, they're not prepared. There's no way the economy could function. It's a lot easier when the private sector has been stress testing against it, building for it, you know, is aligned with net zero faster than you are. And so it's hard to see, you know, private sector success creating more public policy dysfunction.
All right. I think we'll end it there. Karen and Carsten, thank you so much and looking forward to our next check-in.
Thank you, Jake.
Thank you, Jake.